So just a quick story about the hospital, old hospital at Mount Tabor. I don't know if I told you this. I don't think I did. If I did, stop me because it's a waste of time to tell it again. But like I said, my grandmother went into surgery and never came out conscious. They got her heart stopped, and they got it going again, and then she was in a coma. And my parents were devastated. At that time, they did not have the picture of God that I was able to later to give them. And all they could think of was that God was punishing them for something they had done wrong. And so every time we drove to Portland, which for a while was every day, an hour trip, every time they would discuss what they did that must have offended God. It was such a dark time, and we'd go to my grandmother's bedside, and my dad would tickle her feet because she was very ticklish, and he would call mother, 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 and she would not respond. And it finally got to be so hard on the family that my mother said to my dad, "You go visit your mother as often as you think you ought to, and we'll go on week on Sabbath. But we just can't keep this up." So my dad went on Thursdays and Fridays to see my grandmother. And one Friday he came home just really happy. And he said, "I something wonderful happened today." And my mother said, "What? Did grandma wake up?" He said, "No, but I had a wonderful visit with the chaplain, Chaplain Hartnell." And he said, "I really want you to talk to him."
To your mom?
Well, he said, "I really want you to talk him to talk to us," is what he said. And mom said, "Why do we need a chaplain? We're Seventh-day Adventists. We don't need a chaplain."
Oh,
And they, my, she and my dad went round and round and round. My parents never really fought at all. They just occasionally argued.
Did a couple rounds of play.
It never was angry. It was just frustration, maybe, but not anger. Anyway, they did that all week long, and my dad won, which was amazing because my mom could be a very controlling person. And so we went to Portland, and all the way there, my mother said all the things she could think of that would say, "We don't want to see this man." She said, "You know, he's a chaplain. He's paid to say nice things about God. It
Wow.
doesn't mean, you know, that he really cares about us, et cetera, et cetera." And I sat in the back seat going back and forth between mom and dad, wondering which way I stood.
You're what age?
I was 7 going on 8.
Oh.
We got to the hospital. We went up to the floor my grandmother was on, and we met Chaplain Hartnell. And he looked at us and he said, "You know, the hospital is just not a good place to talk about these things. Let's go to my house. I'm right across the street from the hospital." And I was very skeptical. I was like, "Does this man really care about us or not?" Because I was taking on my mom's role. We got into his apartment, and it was like a teacup. It was so small. Tiny little living room, tiny little dining room, tiny little kitchen. We had to almost sit knee to knee in a circle in order to fit in. He apologized. He said, "I'm so sorry. This is such a small place." But he said, "When we came, we've only been here a few months. And when we came here, we wanted a place that was close to the hospital so I could see my patients quickly. And this was the only place we could find." And all my prejudice died right there. I was like, "Okay, I'm ready to listen." And what he told was a story that I had never heard before. And that was the cosmic conflict. And he told how this wonderful God who created us didn't want us to die. But that Satan had made him out to be a tyrant, and that all sin and suffering was caused by him and not by God, and that we didn't need to blame ourselves or do anything like that.
That's right.
When I walked out of that house, the sun was shining. It hadn't been when I went in. Sunshine as a child, because we had so little of it in Oregon, was kind of a symbol of God's love to me. And when it was shining, he was loving me. Sun was shining. It actually still was high fog, but it was shining enough that to me it was glorious. And my whole frame of reference had changed. And my whole picture of God had changed. I remember a few months later, in November, I was in a long line of cars in the back seat of my cousin's car. Her husband was driving us in a long line to the cemetery to bury my grandmother. And my cousin was just weeping copiously because grandma had been her mother through much of her life. And I wanted to reach out to her and say, "Marion, please know that God loves you. He's not angry with you. This is not your fault. He didn't do this to Grandma. Satan did." But I was afraid she wouldn't understand because I was the youngest cousin. And so I didn't say anything. I just prayed for her. That's my story. It's my introduction to the Great Controversy.
Wow.
That's a beautiful story, Jean, and I could see the emotions in your eye as you
Well,
talked
I
about
just about cried.
that shift. Yeah, you could see how profoundly impactful to you
Well, it
and
means so
to
much
your
because
family. Yeah.
you think of what would have been the alternative.
Yeah.
It would have just trapped me all the more.
Yeah.
And I just love Chaplain Hartnell. When I get to heaven, he's going to be one of those people I look up and I say, "Thank you. I'm here in part because of you."
Cool. Just curious, did your mom get over her ill feelings of we don't need him?
I never heard any more.
No.
That's the best I can say. Mom wasn't one to back down easily, so there was no confession, I think, but I didn't hear any more about God punishing them or anything like that.
Well, that's cool. Good. Nice.
We are now beginning the part of the Great Controversy that has more to do with us on earth. Revelation 13.
So we're doing a flyover preview.
Yeah, I thought we would. I thought we could have Nancy read it.
You
Quite a
could have
long
Trish read it in Greek.
not even I would understand it because I never learned to speak Greek or hear Greek. I only learned to read it, and I even have to have a dictionary for that. So I could probably get more out of Spanish because I've studied French, but even with that.
I think there's enough symbolism without the Greek.
It is
There
Greek,
you go, friend. You got it.
What's that, Trish?
Oh, I don't think I should read it in Greek. I just wanted to say it is very beautiful in Greek.
It would be fun to hear you read it sometimes in Greek because I'll hear, a few words, but I've never heard Greek spoken,
Yeah, neither
sentences,
have I.
paragraphs. I've only heard, well, this is how the Greek word is said. It's always been singular words. So it's a
Sure.
beautiful language, Trish.
It is. Yeah, it is beautiful. Maybe next time I can definitely read, I could read it now like a sentence, but if you really want to hear the flow, maybe do it next time. I could practice a sentence or two so I don't stop. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that
Well,
would be
actually,
wonderful.
so it sounds beautiful when you read it.
Oh, or if you guys, just listen to, there's so many YouTube videos, by native Greek speakers, if you're just curious. I think to my ear, it's probably the most, I don't know if it's got connotations, but to my ear, it's the most beautiful language I've ever heard. But that's just, I mean, I speak French too, but anyway. It is pretty. It's very pretty. That's one. Yeah.
Because I've heard French, different languages. Sometimes I can identify what nationality or what language it is, but I wouldn't be able to identify Greek, I don't think. Mm-hmm. So yes, sometime it would be fun. Okay, Jean, okay. How much do you want me to read the whole chapter?
Whole chapter, because we're going to do an overview.
Okay. So here's Revelation 13. I'm in Free Bible Version. Verses 1 through 18. And the dragon stood on the seashore. Then I saw a beast rising out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 small crowns on his horns, and had blasphemous names on his heads. The beast I saw looked like a leopard, but his feet looked like those of a bear, and his mouth looked like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power, his throne, and great authority. One of his heads seemed to have suffered a death blow, but this fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was filled with wonder at the beast, and they worshiped the dragon because he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, asking, "Who is like this beast? Who could defeat him?" He was given the ability to make great boasts and speak blasphemies. And he was also given the authority to do this for 42 months. As soon as he opened his mouth, he spoke blasphemies against God, his sanctuary, and those who live in heaven. The beast was given power to attack believers and defeat them. And he was also given authority over every people, tribe, language, and nation. Everybody living on earth will worship him. Those whose names had not been written in the book of life that belongs to the Lamb slain from the beginning of the world. If you have ears, listen. Anyone who has to go into captivity will go into captivity. Anyone who has to die by the sword will die by the sword. This demonstrates the patient endurance and confidence in God of the believers. Then I saw another beast rising up from the earth. He had 2 horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. He imposed the same authority as the first beast on his behalf and made the earth and those who live there worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. He performed great miracles, even bringing fire down from heaven to earth while people watched. He deceived those who lived on the earth by the miracles he performed on behalf of the beast, ordering the people that they should make an image for the beast who had received the fatal sword wound but came back to life. He was permitted to bring life into the image of the beast so that it could speak, ordering anyone who did not worship it put to death. He made everyone, whether weak or powerful, rich or poor, free or slave, receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads. Nobody was permitted to buy or sell except those who had the mark, which was the name of the beast or the number of his name. Wisdom is needed here. Whoever has understanding should calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666.
This seems to read like a story again. Mm-hmm. So this is the sequel.
It's interesting to note the literary nuances or inserts, alerts. I've never figured out what to call them all, but I think they're helpful for understanding the flow of the narrative. And also to keep in mind that it's coming out of the previous chapter where it says the dragon went to make war. And this whole chapter is saying this is how he's doing it. So without that context, we've typically studied this chapter independent mm-hmm. of context. but it's an expansion of that phrase from the previous chapter. And then after the first beast comes up, in fact, I think the very first verse here, you know, the dragon who went to make war, so now he's on the seashore. He's the one sort of supervising or instigating everything that's going to happen the rest of the chapter. So he's orchestrating the sea to come, you know, to give up the beast. Then he's orchestrating the one to come up out of the land. And then he begins to fade from view because they are his front men. Or they are the agents that are now acting in his behalf. But, you know, there's a telltale clue where it says that they worship the beast, but they also worship the dragon. So in worshiping the beast, they're worshiping the dragon, because the beast and the image and all those are simply, yeah, simply communicators or images of the dragon. You know, cooperative creations of the dragon, you might say. But after the first beast, then suddenly there's this insert of verse 9 and 10. And I've noticed that throughout Revelation. You're reading along, and all of a sudden it's like, what? What's that have to do with anything? So you have to stop and say, well, what does it have to do with something here? And why is it located right here?
So you're referencing 9, if you have ears, listen, and then the following, anyone who goes into captivity will go into captivity, and who has to die by the sword will die by the sword. So
that's like a narrator's comment. It's not part of the narrative. It's a notation. Oh, by the way, reader, be alert about something. Don't. Or you need to be aware of this principle or whatever it is they're making you aware of, or you're going to misunderstand what we're talking about here.
You're just going to go with the flow of the story and not get the right point. There's a counterpart to that in Hebrew, in the Psalms, and it's something that no scholar knows what it means. And I have to tell my students, I don't either. But I wonder sometimes if it could mean to pause and think, or to pause and be alert. And that's that little word, salah.
Yeah.
At the end of different sets of poetry in the Psalms.
Stop and let it soak in.
But nobody's been able to pinpoint it, because there's no word like it. There's absolutely nowhere to go to find something that would tell us what it means.
So it's interesting, Floyd, when you bring that up. So, because we hear Jesus repeating to each of the 7 churches, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. You know, so it's, I want you to get this. I want you to get this. And it's interesting to me that it is tied to these difficult things, captivity, death. And it's still calling out that patience, that endurance, and that confidence in God, because these are scary beasts. These are horrifically scary, very powerful, ferocious beasts who can say, yeah, you can buy, sell, you know, they're all connected to this control power over structure that Satan is used to using.
Yeah. And what they're going to do is force everyone to bow and scrape or die. Everybody's gonna have to lay their life on the line if they want to keep from worshiping the beast.
You know, even at that point into the chapter, and I struggled to study this chapter because it's so dark that you lose perspective. And it's statements like this that alert you, okay, I understand it's really dark, but don't start thinking like the beast. Just because we're talking about the beast and the methods of the dragon and all that stuff, because we've been conditioned to for so much of our life, we start interpreting what we're reading from their perspective. And so what I see there in verse 9 is a reminder of the gospel, number one, mm-hmm. that, okay, you need to be reading this differently than how you typically read things. Verse 10 is a principle. And if you don't understand how principles work in the kingdom, then you're not going to get it. But he's talking to believers who probably the early believers understood it better than we do. They were closer to the original. Mm-hmm. But I think it's the principle that when in the Gospels where he said, with the judgment you use, it will be used against you. Mm-hmm. It's the principle that whatever system you embrace, that system is going to be the one through which you experience and interpret everything that happens to you. So if you're into killing, then that's what's going to happen to you.
Those who use the sword will perish by the sword.
That's right. And he's saying, if you've got an ear, if you're listening, if you're tuned into the Spirit, pay attention, because this is going to be really, really easy to miss. So just stop right here before we even go to the next beast. Take a selah, sit down, think about this, pray about it, soak on it until you get it before you read the next beast, or you've lost, you got lost in the details.
Mm-hmm. There's a note on 13:10, which you're just referencing in the Free Bible, where Jonathan Gallagher said there are two textual variants here. The text could also say that those who kill with the sword will themselves be killed with the sword, paralleling Matthew 26:52. However, in view of the next verse that encourages the believers to endure persecution rather than expecting retribution, the text is translated as the one preferred here. So I thought that's interesting. Yeah. Because when you're experiencing stuff like that and you're facing these ferocious you know, beasts, what we have in the movies now, is then you have these more terrible, more awful, more powerful beasts that come up and they do battle and take each other out. That's our human, you know, human perspective. And it seems like God is saying, yep, hold on, wait, endure. The good will still come out of what seems terrible. Retribution.
It seems to me that we have this human nature that when we're faced with death or torture or whatever it is, we are faced with the question of whether we are going to surrender to that torture in a way that will make us the next torturers, or whether we're going to surrender to love and love our enemies. And we can't, it's very binary, because we cannot go one just part way. We either have to go all one way or all the other way. I mean, the closest that we can come to going part way is the mark of the beast on the hand instead of on the forehead.
But it's just as deadly.
It's just as deadly, yes.
It's the deadly compromise. Oh, I don't believe it. I just do it so that they don't kill me. So I can continue to buy and sell.
Well, and that only works if you're willing to be afraid.
Not being able to buy and sell.
Force and coercion are intended to bring you around to operating the same way they operate.
Exactly.
And I like the footnote that's what you guys been saying on the Passion Translation. Then I saw wild beast. Now, the word beast, therion, is used in the Bible for an evil person or a description of sinful nature of man. It goes on to say that that's an example to see. John was not just giving us a code word for Emperor Nero. He was pointing out to us the sin of man that turned Nebuchadnezzar into a beast in Daniel 4. Or to a riotous human. So that was interesting.
So I can't resist reminding us that the two creatures in this chapter are in Job. are taken from Job. Job 40, the behemoth.
Yeah.
The word, Hebrew word for beast.
The land beast.
And the Leviathan is
the sea beast.
The sea beast. And he is the great dragon-like creature that lives in the deep. And as a counterpart to, maybe not a counterpart, but a parallel to Tiamat in Mesopotamian literature. This has a back history, backstory that figures a lot in Job's Theodicy and the problem of evil. But there, it's just extolled by Yahweh as being a wonderful creature. Here, it turns into a deadly beast.
Well, the Leviathan?
Behemoth.
Oh. Okay, I got a question that's lingered for most of my life. Sort of a big picture question as far as Revelation. You have a dragon, then you got a beast, then you got a beast, then you got an image. And if you follow the narrative, pretty much after this chapter, it's mentioned repeatedly, those who worship the beast and his image and have the mark, and sometimes name and number, mostly the mark. But it always turns into just one beast. In this chapter, there's two beasts, but one of them sort of evaporates out of the scenario or something. And the way it was taught to me, even that was confusing, because the first beast started getting mixed up with the harlot, but then the harlot's on the beast, and it's like, wait a minute, I thought that beast looks like the dragon, but now you're talking about the beast, and what, you know? And the identities started getting scrambled, and they keep, and then you end up in, what is it, 17 or 19, and all of a sudden, the false prophet. What? Where'd that come from? That wasn't mentioned before. Where, you know, it says the beast and the false prophet. Wait, it used to be a beast and an image. Now it's a beast and a false prophet. So why the shift in identity? I don't know. It's confusing.
Because Satan doesn't like just one. He likes many roads to hell.
Yeah. But it does seem clear in this chapter that the second beast is primarily there for getting people to worship the first beast and helping to facilitate the creation of an image, evidently, to the first beast, because I think it specifically mentioned that they compel the world to worship the image and the beast. Didn't it say first beast? Yeah, who had the wound. So all the attention is being directed back to the first beast. All the worship is being forwarded or referred back, and yet the image demands worship, both for itself and for the first beast. And we talk about a false trinity here, which I believe that. But even that's confusing, because if you have the beast and the image, okay, that's three. But wait, what about the dragon? You know, that's four. But then the second beast sort of evaporates. So now you got three again.
The thing that comes to my mind, and maybe this doesn't fit, but I think it does at least partially, is in, if you take Rachel Magdalene's view of the two defendants and the two accusers in the book of Job, the first accuser disappears before the end of the book. The second accuser appears suddenly at the end of the book and then disappears before God gives the judgment.
So the first two accusers would be the dragon and the first beast?
I'm not trying to parallel them with this. I'm just saying there's an antecedent of these disappearing and reappearing or appearing, suddenly appearing characters in a plot. And it may have to do with accusation, and it may not. This, to me, chapter 13 sounds like a totalitarian government, a regime.
Well, if they're all operating according to the principles of the dragon, and he's the ultimate dictator, he invented dictating, coercion, intimidation, force. You know, they're just creations of his that multiply and magnify what he wants to counterfeit what the Godhead does. And I see the image as a direct affront to man being created in the image of God. So now Satan says, well, we're going to have an image. We're going to create an image in the image of the dragon and the beast.
Mm-hmm. So different from God's image and what God created us to be like, because this image is saying, there's no freedom here. You either worship me or you die.
Mm-hmm.
It's so different. And it's interesting. That's how Satan is working through all these mechanisms to be worshiped. That was his last request of Jesus, is fall down and worship me and I'll give you all of this. And somehow these beasts, governments, people in power, they're using that power, and it's all being manipulated by Satan to ultimately lead to him being worshiped. And this is how he gets everybody in the world to worship. Either they believe it in their minds and accept it, or they just go along so they're not impacted negatively by not being able to buy and sell.
Okay, why else would polytheism exist all around the world? You have many gods. If you won't take this god, maybe you'll worship me through this god. And if you won't take that god, maybe you'll worship me through this god. And the Bible says in a number of places that the gods are the demons.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
There's no doubt that this whole chapter is saturated with the word worship, along with the next chapter. And it's probably a very ripe time to really flush into the open what in the world is worship. Because mm-hmm. that word was so vague for me, and I think for a lot of people, most of our life, that it has to be defined in non-religious terminology so that it actually makes sense to us as English-speaking human beings.
Right.
I'm just wanting to look up, because this is a word I haven't studied a lot, and I'm looking up to find out what words are translated in the King James Version.
As worship, Jean?
Yeah, I'm looking up worship to see which words in the King James Version are translated as worship. Well, there's an Aramaic word, a special Aramaic word that means to bow down and do obeisance. That is a standard way of worship. It describes the way one worships, not the worship itself.
Right.
And there's another word in Hebrew to make an idol. It's to worship. To serve. Abad. Serve as a slave, a servant. And this is used about Baal worshipers and the servants of the Lord who are present at the Baal worship on Mount Carmel. That's very fitting, because worship in the ancient Near East, especially in Mesopotamia, was to serve the gods as a slave. Because in the creation mythology of ancient Mesopotamia, the gods created human beings to be slaves, to be their slaves. That's the counterpart to the image of God in Genesis 1.
Okay, flush that a little closer, because serve is something Jesus promoted.
But he didn't mean it in a slavery type of meaning, even though Paul uses it in a slavery type. Paul, slave of Jesus Christ, the word is doulos. That usually means slave.
Yeah, God says, come now, let us reason together.
Yeah.
You know,
but it doesn't, it's qualified by how Paul operated. He meant slave because I'm totally devoted to the point of doing anything for God that he wants me to do.
And a slave does what?
A slave serves his master, usually out of fear.
So how could, if you worship God in the next chapter and give glory to him, and the beast says, you worship me or I'll kill you, and it's the same word probably for worship, because Satan always hijacks the words. They're always usually the same word, so that doesn't help a lot. Then, again, we have to define what is the same and what is different in these worship, in these kinds of worship. Because to serve, you know, we just said that serving God is from a different motive than serving the beast. And that's very true. But what is the common denominator that is still in the word worship? There's got to be a common denominator between the two, even though they have different motives.
Would it be with understanding, like 15:15, where God doesn't want us to be slaves or servants, but he wants us to be friends so that we would understand? If you're a servant, you do it because you're told to. You don't question, you just do it. If you're a friend, God wants us to understand why we're doing it. He wants us to understand his character as to who he is.
Absolutely.
Okay, excellent. So that would be the difference. What's the same that where you can say you're worshiping the beast or you can say you're worshiping God? It's easier to see what the difference is. But what is the same about the worship? Another question, very relevant to it. What did Satan mean that Jesus understood when he said, bow down and worship me? You know, that baffled me for most of my life. It's like, you're asking the creator of the universe to bow down. What does that mean? You know, how it doesn't even compute in most of our thinking. It's like, because the action, the outward actions is not the issue here.
I think that you have to assume certain things are going on in the mind of Satan and the mind of Jesus.
And that's what I want to get out in the open.
Satan is trying to persuade Jesus that he is a fallen angel. And therefore, you know, give in. Just bow down and worship me, and I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world, and I'll let you have them, fallen being. Jesus perceives that this is definitely not God, because God would never demand his worship.
But we don't know that, because we've been raised to think that God does demand worship.
Incorrect.
And I mean, you could argue that from fear God and give him glory, for the hour of judgment come, worship the one who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water. You could argue that this is good news. This is message. This is not command.
And I think I go back to Revelation 5, when the lamb is poised, the lamb that was slain is poised to open the scrolls, and he's poised to break the seals and open the scrolls. And I love the new song where they are singing, you are worthy to take the book and open its seals, for you were slain, and with your blood you redeemed for God people from every tribe, language, people, and nations. You know, and then you have these millions of angels, and everybody joins in, and they say the sevenfold, kind of like a, they include these essential components of worship. They said, the lamb that was slain is worthy to receive authority. You know, why is he worthy to receive authority? Because he was willing to die, shed his own blood to show us the consequences. So authority, wealth, wisdom, strength, honor, glory, and blessing. And it seems to me that that's what's pivotable and what the difference is between worshiping the lamb, worshiping God as the lamb reveals, and the kind of worship here that you say, you know, who's like this beast, you know, and he's making these pronouncements, you do this or die, or you do this, or, you know, they're worshiping out of fear, not out of, wow, what a great character that is revealed, you know, whereas the song, the new song is all related to God's character. That's why we worship, because he is who he is. To me, that's the pivotal difference.
So do we worship the dragon because he is who he is?
Because we're scared. He's got the power. I mean, what,
because he has power. If you contrast the worship of the beast with Michael's name, who can fight the, who is like the beast and who can fight against it? Mm-hmm. That is a direct parallel to Michael's name, but it's a contrast as well. Michael's name means who is like God. Mm-hmm. And the beast's name is who is like the beast, who can fight against it. There's nothing about fighting with God. There's just who is like God. And that word like, I believe, is a reference to God's character, who is would, like God in
would
character.
That not be tied to the word in Genesis 1?
You shall be like God.
No, that's Genesis 3. Genesis 1, let us create man in our image and in our likeness. Mm-hmm. However, when he created them, in the next verse, he left out the word likeness. And it puts in image twice. When he talked about it, he used image and likeness. When he carried it out, he only used image. The likeness was missing. And I believe, and this is where the dots start really connecting for me, likeness is character that is developed by the person themselves. God doesn't create character. He creates potential for character, capacity for character, but the character comes by who you worship.
There you go.
And it turns you into becoming like who you worship. So that's the likeness. So who is like the beast? Everybody who worships the beast is like the beast.
Exactly. I was just going to raise a question. Why? What does Jesus, our creator, know about us that we become like the God we worship? And so he said, don't have any other gods before me.
Yes, yes.
What is that for? It's to prevent what happened to Adam and Eve is what it's for.
Well, yeah. And that's happened why
to the whole world since. Go ahead.
That's why that second commandment has the visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children. It's reference to idol worship and its consequences generationally.
Right.
The thing I would like to point out, and Floyd, before we leave this, you brought out your foundation stone is this likeness being left out. Robert Alter says that whatever is repeated, if it's changed, it's significant. It has meaning in Hebrew. Oh. So there's meaning in that likeness not being used, and it parallels something that Jacob Milgram pointed out in our Leviticus class. Somehow we wandered into Genesis and we were dealing with Genesis 1. And he pointed out that everything is pronounced good except human beings.
Ooh.
Why? Because they have capacity to fall. And I think the likeness being left out the second time is marking the same thing. It's a double marker.
And it's reflected at the other end of the Bible in 1 John, where it says, we don't know what we're going to be like, but we know we'll be like him because we will see him as he is, not as we imagined him to be. We're going to see him as he really is, but because we have been worshiping him and learning from him, you know, taking his yoke on us, learning of him, meek and lowly, then when we see him, it's like, oh, yeah, that's exactly what he said he was like. Not like the beast.
We see through as a mirror darkly, but then face to face. And I think of an experience I had that ties in with this this week. I had had a really bad day the day before. And I was kind of not such good shape. And the next day, I was teaching a class on who the angry God in the sanctuary. And I don't know if I've told you, I believe I told you that Azazel can mean angry God. And so I was leading everything up to that, pointing out there is no angry God in Genesis and all the different component parts when I came up to this. I got through with class and I felt a stillness and an awe in the students. They just sat there. And then they slowly got up and walked out. And all of a sudden, it was like God was there right in front of me. And I could feel his glory. And all the things that happened the day before just melted away. I was totally free. And in that glory, I think we are reflectors of that glory. We're not as robots, but in the sense that we absorb something of God's nature, his character, and it comes from just being in his presence.
Like Moses.
Yeah.
It radiates back out.
Yeah.
And that's also repeated in, again, Revelation 7:11, because I've pondered and I go, okay, this is a sevenfold kind of repetition of where all the angels, everybody around God's throne in that glorious place, they say blessings, glory, wisdom, gratitude, honor, power, and strength. So these seven characteristics be to God forever and ever, you know, and they're able to reflect what they are in the presence of. And that is, in my mind, why they worship.
Yes.
And all those things listed, I think, are the controversial issues of the war. How does God use power? What is glory? Who should the glory go to? Every one of those are sticking points. That's why they're listing those.
Yes, I think so too.
Trish, I have a question for you. What does proskuneo really mean? Or is it proskunomai?
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, so proskineo? Well, worship, right?
Right.
But if you break it down, if you break it down into the, I mean, again, I don't know if this is accurate, but I just think it's interesting. If you break it down into the parts of the word, you know, pros means towards.
Right.
Yeah, and then kineo, I think, is I move. It's like from kinetic and all that.
Move towards.
So it's proskuneison here. It's Q, not K.
No, it's ki. Okay, what? Okay, so I actually looked it up. So kineo.
Oh, it is kineo.
And in modern Greek, it is kappa epsilon. So okay. It's the same. Kappa epsilon ni.
Yeah.
Okay, so that means movement. So it's like towards movement. So I would guess that Worship means something that motivates you to move.
Move before. Okay.
In him we live and move and have our being.
So move before means that that person is drawing you in.
Whoever you are becoming like, you are moving towards being more and more like them.
Well, I mean, I suppose it could have all those interpretations. It's kind of, you know, non-specific, but yeah, that idea of like whether you're being drawn to movement in a certain direction yourself or drawn to movement towards something. Yeah, you know, I suppose any of those, depending on context. But of course, I mean, it does mean worship. So I get there. There's always this temptation to take a word and pull it apart and give it, you know, some kind of nuance, which I think is oftentimes accurate, but
it just can't be proven.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, of course, you know, we didn't like, there's lots of words in English, you know, that we could have a certain meaning that we all accept. And then you could break it down into its parts and it's kind of similar, but it's not exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. Right. So mm-hmm. I think we do need to accept it means worship, but then what does worship mean to those people at that time? And to us, really, too, because, I mean, when we worship, we also, you know, are drawn to physically express our mm-hmm. emotions and our faith, right? So, but anyway, it isn't, like I said, for me, it's just more kind of fun because I like words and playing around with them to see that it does mean prose toward and then toward movement. So you're being drawn to movement in some way when you're worshiping. Mm. So yeah, like Boyd, like you said, drawn to movement to be more like God or more like, you know, whoever you're worshiping.
So it depends if you're talking about physical movement or emotional movement or social attraction. Or I don't know what other kinds of movement are there. Your blood moves around in your body, but
well, that's physical. And I mean, the Greek word here is physical movement.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that fits with the other Bible verses I'm thinking of that fit this biblical principle. You become like the God you worship, but by beholding, you become changed.
Mm-hmm.
That's 2 Corinthians or whatever it is. I can't remember. But then in Psalms 115 verses 9. Those who make them, you know, will become like them, and so will all who worship them or trust them. That's the other biblical. And then the 2 Corinthians 3:18, all of us then reflect the glory of the Lord with unveiled faces, and that same glory becoming from the Lord, who is the Spirit, transforms us into his likeness in an ever greater degree of glory. So they don't tie directly to worship, but that's a biblical principle, it seems.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a biblical principle, yeah.
What I get that in ancient times from the Scott Little and Scott dictionary is that it means to bow down before, to prostrate oneself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be the movement toward.
That's the movement, yeah.
So that's the physical manifestation of worship.
Yeah, the outward.
The outward. But sometimes, often in ancient times, that outward movement of, we're so thought and left-brained oriented.
Yeah.
That we don't have those moments of sheer awe that make us do that.
Yeah.
We're so reserved and we're so pointed toward rational thinking first and then movement. But I was reading All My Glory by Terry Fivesh. Thank you, Floyd, for getting me onto that book. And at the very end of the story, she has Pharaoh sensing El Shaddai's presence. Not El Shaddai. What was it? Anyway, it was one of the God names that she uses all through the book. And he was sensing his presence and exclaiming, somebody else is here. And Joseph said, yes, it's El, and he named it. And they both, then it came in all its glory. and they flatten on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that's the ancient mindset that was very close to fear most of the time when it came to worship. I think if God said, thus saith the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, but let him who glories glory in this, that they know me and understand me, that I'm a God who exercises justice, love, and mercy, or in these things I delight. I didn't get that quite straight, but that's the general sense of that text. And it seems to me that this is the kind of worship God wants.
Yes.
And that's why Jesus said to the woman at the well, I know you think this place is the place to worship, but Jerusalem, in my society, Jerusalem is the place to worship. But I'm going to tell you the truth. In neither place will you worship. But those that worship me in spirit and in truth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to worship in spirit means to become one. And to worship in truth means that you know the truth about that person and you trust them. Mm-hmm. Truth and trust are related in Hebrew.
I wrestled with this idea of worship a number of years ago, trying to figure out where I could find not just an academic definition, but a practical one. And so I thought, well, okay, worship seems to be intuitive to human beings. Well, cats too, maybe, but particularly humans. And there's all these gods, all the pagan gods. Why were they worshiping their gods? You know, don't denigrate them for doing it. Why? Why did they invent so many gods to worship? What drives them? And so I thought, okay, they had gods of war. Why would you worship a god of war? Well, because you want to win the war and you want extra power or protection or whatever. Okay, so you have gods of rain and sun. Well, what's that for? Well, you need it for your crops to survive. You need to grow food. And you can't control the weather, so you need some supernatural intervention to help you out. On and on and on. It's like, okay, so all these multiplicity of gods is for just one thing. You need outside supplements for what you cannot do yourself, either for protection or to have more kids or to have more pleasure or to have more food or whatever you want. You want an outside force on your side. Of course, now you have to buy them and bribe them and placate them and serve them and do whatever they demand in exchange for that. So it's provision. A god is the source you look to for provision. Okay, that's one aspect of worship. Another aspect of worship that we've touched on all through this discussion, particularly the woman at the well, is identity. She got her identity from Jacob dug this well. We worship on this mountain. You know, we have our version of scriptures. We're right, and you guys are saying we're wrong, and here I'm ready to duke it out with you because my tradition and your tradition are not agreeing, and my identity comes from, and you are reinforcing my identity as a Samaritan and as a woman. At least she's expecting that, which, you know, completely throws her off balance. When he's like, well, yeah, I understand what you're saying. I understand what Jews are saying, but that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying you get your identity from the one who created you. Oh, and by the way, I'm him.
Mm-hmm.
You did what? You're what? Who? What? You mean I have value? outside of what everybody else thinks about me, you mean? Says, yeah.
Yeah.
And she believed it. The one true worship is God wants true worship, not in a place or a theology or a set of rules, but he wants a relationship with you because he created you to love. And he is the source of love. And so if you will get the identity from him, directly from him, it becomes in you this well of everlasting good news. And you won't be able to help. You're going to be dumping it on everybody you meet because you don't need what they are giving you. You're getting it directly from the source. Now you can give it away. So worship is, where do I get my identity? And to me, that is the very heart of worship. So take that back to the temptation of Jesus. What was Satan saying to him? What was the temptation about? If you are the Son of God, that's his identity. But it's been 40 days and a whole lot of hunger since then. And he's trying to plant a doubt about his identity. The whole war is over identity. And he's like, if you will accept the identity I give you, then I'll give you, in exchange for admitting that my ideas have some validity, that my kingdoms actually are helping control the chaos in this world, if you would just admit even one of my ideas is legitimate and acknowledge that, which is a bowing, I'll concede. Of course, he's a liar. How could you even trust him to give you anything if he promised it? Because he's a liar, right? But never mind that. It's a war over identity. And that's why it's the last temptation, because Jesus puts his foot down instantly. He's like, no, I get my identity from the Father. You get behind me. It is written. Worship the Lord your God. Why? Only get your identity from the one who created you. He's the only safe and valid and legitimate source from which to get our identity, from which to depend on to supply our needs. The only one that we can believe to tell us what our genuine worth is. Those are the practical applications of the word worship. And the bowing and the forms and the, I think there are a lot of distractions, because look at how worship works in our world. Sports is a huge arena of worship. We just don't use the word, but it's where worship is. Talk to any avid sports fan, and if you talk to them about their team, they'll worship for hours. They'll worship in front of the TV. They worship in the stadiums. They worship in the workplace when they're debating with each other about why their team did this. And they're getting their identity from their team. If their team lost, they just got a really rotten identity, and they're all bummed out, or even commit suicide. If their team won, they're out lording it over everybody because we're better than you. Your team lost. That's all worship. It's identity. I mean, we could learn a lot from American Idol and Britain's Got Talent. And all. Those are worship sessions, but you can get sucked into that worship real quick too.
But it's false worship.
Yes, it's false. But they are worshiping because they're getting their identity through the system of relative worth. And it's reinforcing Satan's whole system that everybody's worth is based on their performance.
But this goes back to the beginning of Revelation, especially Revelation 5. Who is first worthy?
Yeah.
Worthy art thou, thou King of Saints. I can't remember the whole line. And there's a whole stanza, there's stanzas built on that word, worthy are you. Worthy are you?
And you have to define worthy.
To me, worthy simply means that the person has so manifested themselves. I'm avoiding the word earned. Manifested themselves. They're trustworthy.
There you go, Floyd. I'm with you.
I was working toward that, but I wanted to try to
earn
make
your trust.
I didn't want to use the word earn.
I know it's a commercial term, but the legitimate is
legitimized
trust
their
needs
trust.
To be earned.
I know, and I use that word in ethics classes, but
yeah, but it does have
I
that
think there's,
commercial
there has
flavor
to be a better
to it.
Term. There has to be a better term in the universe.
Yeah. One. Trust has to be won.
Yes. He has won our trust
by
evidence that is demonstrated.
Whereas the trust in the dragon and the beast in this chapter is not won, it's coerced.
Yes.
And it's not even trust, it's compliance.
Yes.
Now, some of them, I think the mark in their head is trust. It's like they've sold into that system.
Jonathan Lord Sacks. No, wait a minute. Lord Jonathan Sacks. I didn't get his full title. Rabbi Sacks. He was the first rabbi of Britain. He gave an excellent treatment of economics in the issue of trust. And he used it in its Hebrew sense. I realized then that the Jews are more likely to see the word faith as trust than all evangelical Christianity combined. Why have we weakened it to belief or faith?
Well, the devil has.
Yeah, I don't like the word faith anymore. It's way too...
It's sappy.
Yeah, it you can put anything under that word, just like love.
And even the devil's belief, but trust is implies relationship, and that's what it saves you.
Exactly. It implies connection that is rooted in
experience.
I don't know how to put it. We don't have words adequately to describe this, really. But it is an attempt to say that we have been won, we have been drawn in, and it's not through blindfolding and it's not through deception. It is an open-faced ability to trust God because
he's love,
trustworthy.
Perfect love casts out all fear.
Yeah, and so Sacks made it very clear that the breakdown in economy is always because we don't have trust. And we don't demonstrate it, and we don't act it out. For someone who doesn't have necessarily our view of God, it was amazing. It's still on YouTube if you ever want to watch it. So you could put Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, who is a professor, I believe, at Cambridge University in England. And this was a talk he did at Cambridge on economics and trust. You could just put trust and trustworthiness and you'd get it. He's passed away since then, but he's written some excellent stuff. Because the word for truth and the word for trust come from the same root. So in my view, truth is what can be trusted.
You're right. Romans 3:23-25 says that very thing.
So trust is, trust can be one kind of trust or another too. Trust is part of worship, but do the people who follow the beast, do they trust him? I guess they trust him to have the power.
They do. If they want power, they trust
they want
him
power,
to have the power
and so
for
they're really
and they'll
worshiping
do anything
power.
To get it.
And I think the biggest difference is those who worship the beast and his image and receive the mark is because they have given themselves, they believe, they've chosen to believe that who is the most powerful will win the war. Those who follow the Lamb and worship the Lamb believe that the one, yeah, what's the counterpart of that? They don't believe that power is going to win the war. They believe that selfless love wins the war, because the hero of Revelation is the Lamb who is violently slaughtered, which mm-hmm. is in defiance of intimidation and power, even because of intimidation and power. And he proves that he has a power greater than death.
So here's a way of looking at that. Which inspires you to awe and reverence most? The thunder and lightning and trumpet sounding of Sinai, or the still, or the quiet voice of Jesus on the Mount of Olives, or the Mount of Blessing as he speaks the Beatitudes? Which is more inspirational? Which is more, which draws you to worship? Is it the loud thunder and lightning and something that shook the Israelites to terror? Or is it the voice on the Mount of Blessing?
I think the whole Old Testament was an experiment, not just for this earth, but the whole watching universe. Can intimidation actually produce righteousness?
Well, it doesn't work on Sinai. 40 mm-hmm. days later, they're worshiping a golden right. calf. And they say, where is our God gone?
Mm-hmm.
But they kept trying it over and over for thousands of years. You know, it's like, well, let's have all these threats. Let's have all these punishments.
I don't think it was just that they kept trying. I think that was, in a sense, they were forced to if they wanted to communicate. Because the whole ancient Near East is like that. Everywhere you go in ancient history, they're awed by power, yeah. Nothing else.
And we're coming back around to it in this chapter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought you said we were coming back around it to this on this earth, and I was going to say yes.
Mm-hmm. That too.
Yeah, the same thing, yeah. I was like, because I think we're in this chapter already. Just hasn't completely developed fully yet, but
yeah, I do too.
Yeah.
What's the Greek word when it talks about in Revelation 13:3? It says the whole world was filled with wonder at the beast, and they worshiped the dragon because he had given his authority to the beast. Is there a Greek word there for wonder? Because their wonder leads to worship. But it's different than what we just discussed in Revelation 5 and Revelation 7.
What's the verse again? Sorry, which verse?
13:3, where it's the last part of 13:3. One of his heads seemed to suffer a death blow, but this fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was filled with wonder at the beast. They worship the dragon because he'd given his authority to the beast. They're worshiping Satan through this beastly power, but they use the word wonder and then they use the word worship. So we were talking about the connection of admiration, trust, saying he is worthy, he's admirable. So I just was wondering what the Greek word was.
Piso.
And what's interesting is it's in there twice in a row.
Okay. It's actually, so Nancy, my translation has it as it's a verb, and it is a verb in the Greek. So my translation says the whole earth was amazed, and it's a Greek verb, which is thaumazo, which means to marvel, be astonished, to wonder. It's like a miracle. So...
Mm-hmm.
A miracle, in a modern Greek, that word
what
is
everybody does.
with a miracle. Everyone does before what?
Powerful performance. It's what everybody does before a movie when there's a powerful exchange of, how should I put it? Maybe I should use sports. Back to sports. It's what happens every time there's a powerful move by some, by your team. You're amazed and you follow that team dedicatedly.
Yeah, exactly. You're astonished.
It's a response. It's a response to power.
And what's interesting, or even warning, I believe, is that is the same word used to describe John's reaction to the prostitute in chapter 17. And I believe that this amazement, wonder, capturing your imagination, whether it's good or evil, it can capture your imagination. It can rivet your imagination, is the precursor to worship.
It's interesting. My version has, I was completely stunned when I saw her.
Yeah. And that's why I believe the angel immediately says, why do you do this? It's like, John, don't, no, don't go there. Because I've noticed, you know, the news is driven by capturing people's imagination. The most titillating information, the most incriminating, the most angering, the most compelling stories, because it's all driven by money. And it's, they're trying to create the wonder factor to get you to watch their channel instead of everybody else's.
Right. They got out sensationalized.
Yeah, sensational.
Yeah, it is sensational wonder.
But that's part of worship. It's counterfeit worship.
That's what I would say. It's counterfeit worship. Because I don't think that people who worship Jesus do so because they're sensationalized.
Right.
They worship him because they're moved.
Right.
To adoration, admiration, appreciation. And there's just a whole host of words that you could use.
Exactly. And he wasn't easy manipulated in the towns where they wanted him to do miracles so they would believe. He wouldn't do it. You know, give us evidence that you're who you are.
While we were talking about the word worthy, I just looked it up in the dictionary. You know, you are worthy is what the saints say, and then list these characteristics. So deserving, special, admirable, commendable, exceptional, praiseworthy, priceless, cherished, you know, treasured, you know, and there's a whole bunch of other ones. But I thought that is, you know, and they say related to, yeah. Anyway, I thought those were interesting synonyms for the word worthy, which can be a noun and it can be an adjective. Anyway, it's interesting.
I'm sure you've heard this, that the word worship in English comes from an old English word, worship. It used to be worship instead of worship.
Yeah, I was reading the history and it says 13th century or something, and it was related to just what you said.
Yeah.
They give the history of the word, where it came from.
Yeah, to me, you can also go back to the root of like worth. So it has value.
Yes.
And value is something that you assign. Which is, again, what the whole war is over. Satan says, my ways of doing things are better and more trustworthy than God's wimpy, letting people get off the hook, not punishing, you know, sappy kind of government. He cannot control chaos by just letting himself be walked over like a doormat. And yet the Lamb comes and lets himself be walked over like a doormat. And we're going, you can't win the war that way. It's like, watch me.
And that was part of what Satan was trying to get Jesus to do, is skip over Yeah. Going through this process of building his character and demonstrating God, he said, I'll just give you all these, you see these wonders of the world, I'll give those to you if you just worship me, and then we short circuit the whole process.
And then I won't get exposed Satan, in the process.
And Satan wins. And, you know, anyway.
And that was at the very beginning of his ministry.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Let me get this temptation. Guy before some damage gets done. Yeah. My character.
Before he exposes me too much.
Let's not mention the fact that I'm projecting my character onto him.
That's right.
Well, and he showed him the kingdoms of the world that he himself had helped men create.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yes.
Including the traditions of men, which were being worshipped in the temple regularly. Mm-hmm.
But it was the system, the refined system of power through hierarchy, preventing chaos by rule of law and law enforcement, mm-hmm. and by relative worth in the whole commerce system. And it said, look, it's working. It's working. I'll even let you take it over and refine it and do it. It's working. Just acknowledge that it works.
That's right. Because Satan's claim was God's law. He makes them up. You can't keep them. Right. They're impossible. So then I love that, you know, Jeremiah, where I will write the law, the new covenant. I will write the law in their hearts and in their minds. I will restore their character. I'll put them back the way they were before. Mm-hmm. Broken trust.
There's a lot left for us to go through. I don't know. It's nearly 5:30. I don't know if you want to call it quits for today.
I just thought it was interesting, Gene. Brad and I, for the last two Sabbaths, have been listening to Dr. Jennings, who's going through Revelation 13 and Revelation 17.
Which is the lesson quarterly.
So that's where the lesson quarterly was. And
that's interesting.
He did a synopsis, basically, of this pamphlet that he has available on his website. So there, where he goes through, you know, the seven heads, the 10 horns, and he does connect what's going on here in Revelation 13 to Revelation 17, which I found it interesting. We're also doing that in this class. And it was a definite, I've read it a couple of times, but this morning some things were clicking into place. It might be interesting if anybody wants to see what they think, because he gets pretty specific, and it's definitely paradigm shift for me from what I was taught and what I, you know, what I was taught growing up is very different. So it's, I thought it was fascinating, and a lot of it makes sense, you know, because he goes into Bible texts and makes some very interesting connections. And it does come down to how does God operate contrasted with how does Satan operate, and how does Satan work through the systems of the world, nation states, and how those nation states typically exert, you know, the 10 horns. You know, it's just very fascinating, especially with where we are in the march of time and what you see going on in the world and how the world operates in contrast to how God is operating.
Well, I think that is the whole essence of chapters 12 and 13 is, well, the whole book of Revelation, really.
Yes.
Is to show first God's side. This is the way God operates. He's like a lamb who is willing to lay down his life because he doesn't want to lose anyone. Mm-hmm. And then go to the beast. It's the direct opposite. The dragon is the direct opposite. I think that I could find this actually in the New Testament and the Old Testament if I look at Job correctly. I've never showed you what I did with my dissertation on Job, particularly with the Leviathan and Behemoth and the 11 animals that are talked about there. But I came to the conclusion that God's justice is cosmological. That is out of creation. and that he loves all his good creatures and all his bad creatures alike. And he takes care of all, both kinds. And consequently, there's suffering in the world. And God does not monitor and foreclose that suffering.
All playing out.
Yeah.
Each playing out. Choices.
There's
in a worship.
There is a parallel that I really believe the author of the book of Job was using on Numa Elish when he wrote chapters 38 to 41, because there are parallels with the Numa Elish all the way through. Behemoth is Kingu Tiamat's consort, who instigates the rebellion, apparently, according to the gods later on. And Leviathan is Tiamat herself. And then the 11 warriors that Tiamat creates to go with her match the 11 animals that God takes care of, that are both predator and prey. And it's, to me, that core of God taking care of his enemies, as it were. Just simply expresses just what Revelation is trying to tell us.
Because ultimately, the best way to understand someone's character is to see how do they treat their enemies.
Yes.
Not their friends, not the people who agree with them. How do you treat your enemies? And
exactly.
God chooses us.
Exactly.
And you can only do that. You can only treat your enemies godly if you only after you first received your sense of value and worth and identity only from God. Because now your enemies have no power to devalue you because you never got any from them to start with.
And that's, the devil has worked so hard at devaluing God and his character.
Yeah.
And he wants to destroy your understanding of what that is. Because he knows the power in it.
So I think next week we're really ready to start looking at the details. Because there's a lot of questions I have about chapter 13 and those details.
If you get a chance, look at Jennings' last two Sabbath schools. He does a quick summation. You can get the book online, but I think it's fascinating. And to me, it makes more sense. And looking at Revelation 13 and Revelation 17, it was just, like I said, I sat through a lot of Revelation seminars, and this was revelatory.
There's two,
a very different way of looking at it.
There's two parts to it. Today's would have been titled Lesson 12, The Seal of God, and The Mark of the Beast 2. So it was part two. Last week's was part one.
Part one.
Would have been Lesson 11, 1 week early.
Anyway, it's fascinating, I thought.
Yeah.
Are we ready for prayer? Or do we want Gracious Father, we thank you for the revelation of Jesus in the book of Revelation. We thank you that you have given us a clear picture, a very simple, profound, and clear picture of the kind of God you are.
Yes.
We thank you that you have also defined and represented our enemy as who he really is. May we fully keep this in mind as we move through time. May we only worship you because you are truly worthy.
Yes.
And not worship the enemy.
That's right.
Give us your grace, your wisdom as we go forward. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Amen.